The studies I'm going to talk about today show how in vitro evolution with nucleic acids can be used to study molecular ecology problems. And since I may have a lot more time than I have material, I may go into some current research that I worked on involving in vitro selection of DNA enzymes. So I'm going to give some background, because I'm unclear as to what the background of the audience is. So bear with me if it's a little simplified for the experts in the fields. I have some notes. Okay, so there are generally two ways of selecting functional nucleic acids. The first is in vitro selection, or CellX, which I believe you'll be hearing about later on in the week, by Larry Gold, which involves selecting functional nucleic acids and then selectively amplifying them, either aptamers or catalysts. Aptamers for a specific ligand or catalyst for a specific reaction. The second way involves you start with an already functional nucleic acid and then induce or incur mutations in an amplification step by mutagenic PCR or perhaps by doping in chemical synthesis to create a starting pool from which you can apply selective pressures to create either a new catalyst or more functional. So the two studies I'm going to talk about, the first of which was done by myself and Jerry Joyce, and the second by Thomas Schmidt and Niles Lehman at the University of Albany. So the first involves the use of a continuous in vitro evolution system and how we can apply a selective pressure to evolve resistance in a population. But first I'll describe the difference between stepwise and continuous evolution. In stepwise evolution, a starting population is challenged to perform a chemical reaction, and by doing so, they pick up a tag. And then they are selected based on the presence of this tag and then amplified. Now, in stepwise evolution, each of these steps requires experimenter intervention. Whereas in continuous evolution, the initial pool is seeded into a reaction where reaction, selection, and amplification all occur in one pot. Subsequent seeding into a fresh reaction pot with all the things required for these three processes allows the evolution to proceed. The nice thing about this system is that it allows the experiment, well, first of all, it's fast. So since none of the since you don't require experimenter intervention at each step, you can do a lot more rounds in a shorter amount of time. And additionally, it allows the experimenter to gradually change the conditions of the evolution by changing the conditions in each pot as you go. So the study I'm going to be talking about, first of all, involves using this continuous evolution system to study a molecular ecological problem, namely...
In the continuous case, you must have somehow the amplification mechanism, the replicator, whatever amplifies the...
Right.
You must recognize the
right.
sequences that...
In just a couple of slides, I'll go into a lot more detail on the system. So let me just briefly say what we're going to use it for. It was developed by Martin Wright in our lab a couple of years ago. So what we wanted to use it for was to study how an enzyme or the propagating molecules in continuous could evolve resistance to a toxicant. Now the toxicant in this system is also an enzyme, and it is capable of binding to the propagating molecule through a recognition domain shown here by the little hand, and then it has a catalytic domain which can cleave the molecule, causing it to be inactivated and unable to pick up its tag for it to go on and propagate. So you can see how one of the ways how this might evolve resistance to the toxicant is that since the toxicant inactivating it is based on this recognition element, the enzyme could change its structure here so as to elude the toxicant. So now I'll go into the continuous evolution system into a little more detail. So the propagating molecules in this case are the class 1 ligase ribozymes discovered by Dave Bartel and Jack Szostak, which are ribozymes that are capable of catalyzing the formation of a phosphodiester bond here. So the ribozyme binds its substrate through standard Watson-Crick base pairing, and then the ribozyme catalyzes the formation of this bond, picking up the tag. So shown here is a schematic representation of the proposed secondary structure of the ribozyme in the continuous evolution system developed by Martin Wright. So the ribozyme, the pool of molecules, is challenged to pool of slightly randomized ribozyme molecules are challenged to first bind the substrate and then react with it, forming a covalent linkage and picking up the tag. Now, first of all, let me say that all this is occurring in the one pot. So after reaction, reverse transcriptase and dNTPs are also in the reaction, and a primer that binds to the 3' end of the ribozyme is then reverse transcribed, forming a cDNA copy of the reacted molecule. Now encoded in the primer, in the substrate, is one half of an RNA polymerase promoter element, so that any molecule that picks up the substrate and then is reverse transcribed forms a fully functional RNA polymerase promoter element that can and then the RNA polymerase is also in the pot, so it can then transcribe and produce progeny. So since many copies of the ribozyme can be produced from one template, you get amplification. So reaction, selection, amplification. The toxicant in our system is itself an enzyme, as I said earlier. It's called the 1023 DNA enzyme, and it was selected by in vitro selection techniques by Steve Santoro in our lab. So the DNA enzyme shown here in blue recognizes its target RNA sequence through standard Watson-Crick base pairing, and then the catalytic core here is capable of catalyzing the cleavage between any pyrimidine or purine residue. So in our system, shown here is the starting ligase. So as to avoid a trivial mechanism of escape, we targeted the DNA enzyme to the same site in the ribozyme where it binds its substrate. Shown here is the residues in yellow. So shown here is a evolution profile as a function of time. So I'll just explain what exactly this is. So we measure the concentration of RNA in the reaction at the end of each transfer. So at the end, for instance, at the end of this transfer, the concentration was here, and then subsequent dilution into a fresh pot, the starting concentration of RNA was here, and amplification and in the next one, and so on. So, and then on the top, let's get this little graphics to remind you. So, and then on the top is the DNA enzyme concentration during the course of the evolution, or toxicant. So, we started with an initial sublethal dose of the toxicant of around 100 nanomolar, but as you can see, the starting molecules were had difficulty amplifying, as indicated by the long periods of time that it took for amplification to occur. Whereas later in the evolution, when the population had acquired resistance, even at a high concentration of DNA enzyme, the amplification was quite robust in a short amount of time. So shown here is the overall dilution factor starting from the first round to the last round. Any questions?
Why in some of the regions like three, I mean, there is, if you look at the third part, you see there is a region which is narrower, but the next region is broader. So why?
Oh, like here?
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess what I'm not saying is that mutagenic PCR was done throughout the evolution so as to introduce diversity back into the population and thus allow the molecules to explore greater sequence space. So anywhere you see a small drop, so after mutagenic PCR, you're not going to get a lot of amplification because there's not a lot of molecules in there that can do the reaction. You know, they've been neutralized by mutations. Whereas where there's lots of amplification, so you don't get a lot of amplification, for instance, here. And but as you can see, it recovers after in a second transfer or third transfer.
So why is there this big drop then at just before 30?
The
right
this one?
Here, right, after acquired seeming resistance, the whole thing is.
Well, so each. Now remember, each one of these, so usually what we do is we do the transfers like five at a time. So you're not always monitoring what your dilution factor is. So that way you can do, you know, 40 rounds in a month or so. And as long as the so you do five rounds, check the concentration of each. It looks okay. In the fifth round, you do five more rounds, check the concentration of each. So so after mutagenic PCR, though, you do get this huge drop in the amount of molecules that are amplified, and so it may take a couple of rounds for it to recover.
Let me make sure I understand what's going on. So at the end of the 30 hours, the molecules have literally changed the shape.
Yeah, I'm gonna go into that. What the changes were made. So, well, there were two mechanisms that it acquired resistance. The first one I alluded to in the introduction, by changing the recognition site to the DNA enzyme. The second one I'll describe in a little more detail later. So, yeah, the bottom axis here is in time, but each one of these transfers, you can pretty much freeze. So, I mean, I didn't work for 35 hours straight. It was, you know, you could freeze the samples in between transfers and this sort of thing.
Is there any particular reason that you do just the first, why don't you continuously dilute it?
Well, continuously dilute it?
I mean, you could just like take out
do 40 transfers at once?
No, just like, I mean,
you're talking about this now. Because it's a slow reaction.
Yeah. Yes.
Well.
The difference would be we wouldn't see these sharp.
I think he's asking for a continuous time evolution, which is one of the things you may be talking about.
It is stepwise in that you have to do the transfer, but it's continuous relative to the other stepwise type of evolution that requires some sort of manual selection. So I'm sort of familiar of what you're talking about. I've seen these flow reactors before, but I'm not sure.
Also, another question is kind of not very relevant. What is the exact difference between the other stepwise we talked and this continuous one? Because the macroscopic processes are still a stepwise step, right?
So the difference is that, for instance, in stepwise evolution, you have to do each step. So reaction is done in a test tube. Precipitated, run on a gel, cut out the reacted band, crush soak overnight, put into PCR, amplified, run that down a gel, cut it out, purify it, put in the case of RNA, you would transcribe it, run that down a gel, purify it, throw into the next reaction, do the reaction, repeat the process. No, you could totally do the stepwise, the same process. The only difference is time. That would take you probably, 3 or 4 months. Whereas this you could probably get done in 2 weeks, 2 weeks to a month, depending.
You could at the same time evolve the toxin.
Yes, and that was the initial concept, was to have a predator-prey type interaction. But the problem is in the system is that the toxicant is unable to replicate, so therefore, yeah, you can't have it making change. I mean, you could do it manually, but this was a lot of work as it stands, so we thought about doing that.
I'm still trying to understand how to interpret this graph, you know, more quantitatively. Essentially, what you observe is that initially it takes a long time to amplify. That means that the amplification rate is slow, and then in the end, it becomes very fast.
Right.
Do you have somewhere a plot of houses? Let's say if you just want to find out what is the logarithmic rate of amplification in each interval,
I will get to that at the end. So we actually did that. We measured the amplification profile for. I'll get to it at the end. Yeah, it's coming.
And there is no real information in the shape of, let's say, the top part of this.
Right.
Envelope of this curve.
Right.
It's just an accident of how you precisely perform your curve.
Exactly. Okay. Yep. The starting pool was a 10% mutagenized pool of the starting ligase. So roughly, I think it's about 10 to the 12th molecules. So it's like a random sampling of the, since there's 135 bases in the ribozyme, it's there's like a random sampling.
So you roughly know at which point you are doing amplification, at which point you're releasing the evolution. You could be just selecting that. You could be just be doing the distilling.
Just the what? I'm sorry?
Well, let me ask this. The mutation is introduced at discrete stages or
So the mutation, there are two types of mutagenic PCR. There's one that introduces mutations at a rate of about 0.7%. So and then there's another, we call it hypermutagenic PCR, that introduces roughly 10% mutagenic rate. So, but it has like a slight bias towards purines, I believe. But anyway, so we started with a hypermutagenic PCR of the starting pool of the ribozyme, and then I don't really recall exactly, but I think a mutagenic PCR was done here, just the 0.7%, and then I think maybe two more regular mutagenic PCRs, and then I think one hypermutagenic PCR at the end, just to let it explore sequence space. Okay. So, after the 40th transfer, the population was cloned and sequenced. And shown here are two representative ribozymes from the population. And so what we saw was that there were three changes in the DNA enzyme binding site, which disrupted the Watson-Crick pairing with it, and two compensatory mutations opposite these two so as to maintain the structure of this helix, which is important for catalysis by the ribozyme with its substrate. So this clone had only a few mutations in it relative to the, besides the five in red, relative to the starting ligase, whereas the ligase shown here had over 15 other mutations in it. And I'll get to what each one. So we first analyzed the ribozyme activity for the starting and evolved ligase 1, the first one, with only the five mutations highlighted in red. And the activity, as you can see, was comparable to the starting ligase. As a function of kcat over km. We also looked at the DNA enzyme activity for cutting the ligase. So the starting ligase, as you can see, was cleaved quite well or by the DNA enzyme, whereas the evolved ligase had developed resistance through this change in the binding site of the DNA enzyme. Now, when a new DNA enzyme was constructed with compensatory mutations in it. To account for these changes in its binding site, as you can see, the activity of the DNA enzyme was completely restored. So the evolved ligase 1 had developed resistance only through a direct change in the toxicant binding site. The second ligase had another mechanism of escape. So shown here is a saturation plot of the activity of the evolved ligase with its substrate and versus the starting ligase. So as you can see, the evolved ligase had a threefold lower Km than the starting ligase for the substrate. So Km is given by this here, concentration, where the rate is half maximal. So which means that a starting concentration of substrate at 2.5 micromolar, the starting ligase would have been 60% saturated, whereas the evolved ligase 80% saturated. So the difference is subtle, but there is a difference. And So, sorry, I was having a Last mic.
Of course, if you take a high concentration of substrate, the differences tend to diminish. If you go to a lower concentration, it would be quite significant.
Right, but that was never changed. It was always 2.5 micromolar in the evolution mix.
But once the ribosome picks up the substrate, it can't be anymore.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to get to. Yeah. So, yeah, so if the evolved ligase was able to bind the substrate faster, it would block the DNA enzyme from binding, and then it could react with it, you know, whenever it wanted. It just, as long as it blocked it, the DNA enzyme from binding, then it could. So as you can see, the maximal rate was actually decreased. So the question is, why didn't the ligase evolve to bind the substrate with, say, a 1 nanomolar km? Well, because unfortunately, most likely the maximal rate would have been reduced as well, and so that ligase would not compete effectively with other ligases in the population. So, next, we wanted to see how the ligase would perform in the reaction. So we seeded a reaction with either the starting ligase in either the presence or absence of 10 micromolar DNA enzyme. So as you can see, the starting ligase performs quite well in the absence of DNA enzyme, but in the presence of DNA enzyme, the amplification is pretty much abolished. So this is essentially one of those peaks on the evolution profile, as you were asking about. So over a period of an hour. The evolved ligase, however, in the absence of DNA enzyme, actually performed slightly better than the starting, and in the presence of DNA enzyme, was able to perform as equally well as the starting ligase in the absence of DNA enzyme. The data could be fit to a logistic growth function here, and a growth rate could be obtained. So, this was just kind of a curious thing I noticed when I was working up the data. So since the growth rate is dependent upon the catalytic efficiency of the ligase and the DNA enzyme, we can compare the specificity of the ligase with its substrate versus the DNA enzyme for cleaving the ligase. So if we put it into this equation where we multiply the catalytic efficiency of the ligase times its substrate divided by the catalytic efficiency of the DNA enzyme by the DNA enzyme concentration, we get a fraction of 0.3. And since if we were to measure the growth rate in the absence of the DNA enzyme, the growth rate was 0.13 per minute. So if we multiply that by the fraction, it gives us a value of 0.4 per minute for a predicted growth rate in the presence of DNA enzyme, and the observed was 0.06, so it's a rough approximation. So, I'm sorry, I guess I didn't say you can actually predict the growth rate in the presence. So, summarize, the two mechanisms the ligase used to evolve resistance was through alteration of the toxicant binding site, but it had to do this without disrupting its own substrate binding site as well as the catalytic function of the ligase. And it resulted in a 2,000-fold lower susceptibility to the DNA enzyme. And the second mechanism was the ability of the second ligase to be saturated initially better and protect the ribozyme by blocking the DNA enzyme binding site. Any questions?
So there was a question yesterday surrounding the fungus growth rate itself changes as time changes. Are you still going to get to that? If the sawtooth kind of occur, the slope changes, steeper and steeper as time goes down.
Oh. No, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question then.
Well, no. The question was essentially, you know, that's the main effect of your evolution, that the slope gets steeper and steeper in your first shape.
Right, curve. Right.
So if you just measure in each interval, if you measure the slope and plot it as a function of time, it should go down and just curious how it goes down.
Oh, okay.
Does it saturate at some point, meaning that the evolution stopped, reached the plateau, or keeps going?
I would speculate that you know, once the ligase had acquired resistance and was able to amplify, that's hard to say because it's a pool of molecules, and so, you know.
Right.
No, we did not do that. No.
Part of the interest is what the other set of experiment I ask you is what did on the growth of bacteria, and it was possible to do this sort of measurement how the growth rate changes with time, and the people sort of developed a theory and so forth to calculate how this should change. And if you have this kind of data, then it's really interesting.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay.
So were there any intermediate steps, for example? I mean, this is what the question I think pointed at, you know, whether you can trace evolution in history.
Yeah.
End product, whether there were any ribozymes that has an intermediate resistance.
Right. So, well, keep in mind that the sequencing, the cloning, the kinetic characterization, I mean, that's a lot of work. I mean, the project itself took me a year to do and write up and get published and that sort of thing. So that was one of the things the reviewers, you know, one of the reviewers suggested was that we do the experiment again and see if we got the same thing, and B, analyze it at periodic points throughout the evolution and see what was going on. But it's a lot of work. So
just trying to understand, does this kind of in vitro evolution, does that occur in vivo, this kind of mechanism also? Well, this really requires experimental.
Well, you don't have a mutagenic rate this high in vivo, typically, unless you're like, I think, I don't know, HIV or something. Mutagenic rate, maybe. But it's still not like 10%. But so I think it's on a much smaller scale.
Returning to your ecology project, mm-hmm. would be very neat. I mean, could you imagine being able to build a system in which sort of a kind of steal the tag system, where if you have two molecules that would where the reaction between them or the interaction would be to steal the tag that enables a molecule to be replicated, so that and attach it to itself.
Competing.
Yeah.
There's actually a guy in the lab who's working on a project that has what's he call it? He calls it a schnorbozymes, and so they're the same enzyme read forwards and backwards, but I think in RNA and DNA. And I think they compete for similar substrates or something like this. But he's still working on it, and it's in the beginning stages. So, but yeah, you can envision. So, there's no more questions. The next study I'll talk about is. The one conducted by Thomas Schmidt and Niels Lehmann. And what they wanted to do was use the same system, this continuous in vitro evolution system, to study and quantitate the molecular heritability of a trait. So I'm a little bit of a novice when it comes to this stuff, so bear with me. So the heritability of a trait can be defined as a measure of the response of the population's phenotypic variation as measured after an evolutionary period, which of course is dependent upon the initial genetic variation. And if it's given a value between 0 and 1, a value of 1 would be a trait that is easily affected during the course of a natural selection, easily affected by natural selection during the course of the evolution. So, for example, say the color of a rose was evolved over several generations, and then, say, exposing it to increasing amounts of light. And that is just an example, so to make the point. So, and then after the evolution, you looked at the number of colors of the rose, and there were, say, 30 different colors. Well, this would have a value closer to 1 because the trait was easily affected during the course of the evolution. Whereas on the other extreme, a value close to 0, say we'll take the trait of the number of heads a human has, and we can probably say that that's not going to be affected over the course of a few generations. So it would have a value closer to 0.
Why call this heritability
rather than variability? This is Niles Lehman's terminology. So, like.
The word defined term is in population genetics. Something to do with how it's how variable the trait is and how much the variation in the offspring is correlated to the variation in the parent.
Yeah.
So if you have a very broad, a trait which is very broadly varying due to some other facts, due to non-genetic facts, then it's not very heritable.
Yeah.
Some
and so they plasticity? Okay. So they actually quantitate it at the end. I'll get into what they actually quantitate the heritability of the trait that they study. So.
Does it distinguish in the case that the space isn't big enough and it's already the whole space is explored, and through the, inheritance, you have lots of variation, but still you are in the same space as before. So. The pair of colors could be changed, supposedly. So, but still, you have the same number of colors as you had before. So, is it? This doesn't show it, right? It gives a 0 for that.
Yes.
So, this definition confused me a little bit. Doesn't it depend on how actively you select? In your example, I know it's ridiculous about growing two heads, but if you actively select for that,
right,
can't you then produce it?
Well, yes, what you do is you look at the trait before the evolutionary period and then after, and then you look at the change that occurred. And if that is a huge change, then whatever the selection pressure was, you would say that it was responded well or bad, or not no response.
I guess maybe it's hidden in the definition of evolutionary period.
Yeah. Time. But anyways, so the trait that the authors wanted to study was that of conformational reactivity. So shown here is the advantage of an enzyme that has multiple conformations has on a fitness landscape compared to that of an enzyme that only has a few conformations. So in red are the dominant conformations, and in blue, alternate conformations that the enzyme can explore. So as you can see, the
vertical axis in this landscape,
fitness of the enzyme.
Effectiveness is an enzyme.
Yes. Okay, so as you can see, since the multiple conformations can adopt alternate conformations, they can explore neighboring peaks on the fitness landscape and perhaps fold into a more active structure to attain higher peaks on the fitness landscape. So the phenotype they're going to study in this case is fitness of the enzyme, and it's given by this equation here, where it's the sum of the fraction of each conformational isomer times its respective reactivity.
Can you explain again what multiple conformation versus single is? I mean, what is the definition of multiple? Given molecules or the populations may be different
conformations? No, a single molecule. I'm sorry. I didn't say that. Yes.
Different configurations.
And some of those are more active than others.
Well, the molecule can shift its shape.
Right. Correct. Yeah.
What one needs to make sure that one understands that we are not talking about fast equilibrium between two different conformations, as would happen very often in allosteric enzyme. You are talking here about a situation in which a particular enzyme sort of metastably or even stably exists in several different conformations, and you can really look at what is in the test tube is a mixture of different kinds of enzymes, and that then evolution could shift the balance between them. Am I right in saying that? Just having...
Yes, that is ultimately what they're going to do. Yes. They're going to use evolution to shift the balance to more active conformations.
You mean whether the single molecule is actually wiggling back and forth between these two conformations, or whether any given molecule that you would pull out of the test would be stuck in one of the conformations? But in different instances, the same sequence is stuck.
In this case, the ribozymes can adopt multiple conformations. Yes, as I will get to. Did I answer that?
I guess both. After thinking a little more about it, which is okay, also if it's a fast equilibrium, because in the end there will be some kind of ensemble.
Right. I mean, there's an equilibrium rate between each of these alternate conformations and each of the dominant conformations as well, right? So the dominant conformations probably have fast equilibria, you know, whereas the alternate conformations probably slow. But they can still go there and perhaps attain higher peaks on the fitness landscape. So how did the authors want to select for more active conformations? Well, especially with active conformations of, in this case, a nucleic acid enzyme. Well, let me point out that most nucleic acid enzymes require divalent metal cations for activity, for either folding, or the divalent metal can actually be involved directly with the catalysis. So the authors figured that by lowering the magnesium concentration, they would select for ribozymes that needed fewer divalent metals and so would therefore adopt more active conformations. So to do this, they again used the in vitro continuous evolution process, which I described earlier, and so reaction, selection, amplification, just to repeat myself. So the starting ligase they used was the same starting ligase we used, and it was mutagenized to, I think they approximated it at 8%. I'm not sure if they, I don't remember if they did this by doping and chemical synthesis or not, but anyways, it was mutagenized to 8% as the starting pool. They then lowered the magnesium concentration, the divalent metal, in the reaction during the course of the evolution, and it was evolved over 20 transfers. Now, the total magnesium concentration is actually somewhat higher than the amount of magnesium present for the that the ribozyme can use, because also in the mix are all these NTPs and DNTPs, which can coordinate the magnesium and effectively tie it up so that the ligase can't use it. So the amount of free magnesium is a little bit lower. And so they started with a free magnesium concentration of about 16 millimolar, and during the course of the evolution lowered it to about 3.5 millimolar. After the 16th transfer, the population was cloned and sequenced, and shown here is a representative clone that had 9 mutations in it relative to the starting ligase.
This example brings up a question I have about evolution. I don't know if my question makes sense or not, whether for evolution it's always a continuous process or you can make jumps. So for example, this kind of in vitro evolution is an example. Can you reroute some stuff, whatever it is, that, say, eventually doesn't require magnesium at all, but may require something else? I mean,
yeah.
You're just evolving things that require fewer and fewer, less and less concentration.
Right. I mean, you could... Sure, you could. Well, I mean, the nucleic acid catalyst, the active site of this one is I believe it is dependent upon a divalent metal. So you can substitute different divalent metals. So it may work slightly better or slightly worse with calcium, say. But
can you evolve something that doesn't, that works totally differently? If you read these popular books and they talk about evolution of flying or something, evolve something,
Maybe, yeah. It's possible.
You can make, you can probably make a catalytic antibody that will do some of this activity, maybe not very effectively, and maybe without metal ions or some kind of an artificial enzyme. There is nothing absolutely essential about the metal, but because the substrates are highly negatively charged, it helps to have a metal. But you can have arginine, which is also positively charged, as a matter of principle, replace the metal.
So, but the ribozymes do require, they're stabilized by any monovalent ion because, as he said, they are negatively charged. So,
actually, when you're talking about the ribozyme, it's actually worse. Maybe there is almost no way of doing it without. I was answering the question of whether, in principle, metals are needed for such enzymatic activity. The answer is no, but for a ribozyme to do its job, maybe you cannot do it without because it's very negative.
Right. I mean, it has to have either monovalent. The thing about divalent is there's two charges, and so it can stabilize two phosphates coming together, whereas the monovalent, you know, only has one charge, so you don't get you don't get the folding of the tertiary structure with monovalent. No, the secondary structure has actually been shown although it's not published, to be roughly this. So the tertiary structure, nobody's worked on. These large nucleic acids are, as the ribosome shows, the recent crystallization, it's difficult to crystallize large RNA molecules. But no, nobody's ever worked on the tertiary structure of this one. So to measure first thing they wanted to do was measure the overall fitness of the evolved ligase versus the starting ligase. So to do this, they looked at the basically how much the ligation reaction could be driven to completion, or the maximum extent of the ligase. So as you can see, the evolved ligase, it was assayed in either high or low magnesium concentration, was able to react to a greater maximum extent than the starting ligase. So it was able to adopt more active conformations. So they wanted to be able to quantitate this, the overall fitness of the enzyme, so they had to have some way of isolating or looking at the conformational states of the molecule. So they ran it on a non-denaturing polyacrylamide gel, which can separate things based on conformations. So shown here is a mock autoradiogram, because the real one did not scan very well. And so as you can see in the starting and evolved, so here's the starting product, and then the reacted product migrates somewhat slower in the polyacrylamide gel for the starting and evolved ligase. So all I want to point out is that each of the ligases had multiple conformations, and then they looked at the reactivity of each of these conformers. So they were isolated, and the reactivity was studied.
Mm-hmm. They must be quite stable kinetically.
Yeah.
And each stand in its own niche, and you can really tease them apart. And different conformers will run differently, and so on.
Yeah. Yes, these are the stable. So another thing they looked at was they noticed that was the evolved ligase, when it was transcribed, was able to react, had a greater activity than the starting ligase when it was transcribed, freshly transcribed. So this is important in the evolution mix, because there's it has to transcribe, react with the substrate. All this is occurring in one pot, so this is an important parameter. So the evolved ligase was able to react, so it worked better after being initially transcribed. Now, when the ligases were subjected to a folding protocol, the starting ligase was then had a greater activity than the evolved ligase. So the evolved ligase was able to fold better initially. Another thing they noticed was that the dominant conformer of the dominant conformer of the starting ligase, when it was transcribed in the presence of its substrate, was inactive, whereas the evolved ligase, when it was transcribed in the presence of its substrate, was active. So there was some sort of substrate inhibition of the folding of the starting ligase and of the dominant conformer. What they wanted to remember, I said they wanted to quantitate the heritability of this trait, the conformational reactivity. So Shown here is the heritability function, which I'll get to in just a second. So first they had to quantitate the mean phenotype of each of the enzymes. So they did this by using this equation here. And for the starting ligase, it was shown to have a value of 2.1%, whereas the evolved ligase had a value of 5.9%. So they took the each conformer, so say for instance there was 20% of one conformer, so 0.2 times, and it had a reactivity. I guess they normalized the reactivity to some value, and then it was some fraction of that, and they multiply those two fractions to get a value, and then they sum all those values up, and then to get this value here. It's in the paper. I didn't want to put it because it was rather complicated. And like I said, I'm a novice in this area, so they used these values to put into the equation for the heritability function, where R is the response to the evolution, which is measured by the by subtracting the mean phenotype before the evolution from the mean phenotype after the evolution. And S is the maximum response to the evolution, which would be 100% minus the starting response to give that value there, which gives a value for the heritability close to zero. So the overall response to the evolution experiment was small. And so the heritability of the trait of conformational reactivity responds slowly to evolutionary pressures. But there was a measurable response, as shown by the fact that the starting ligase and the evolved ligase were both conformationally heterogeneous, and the various conformers had differing reactivities.
They lower the concentration of magnesium, and before evolution they get 2.1% of the original, or summed over all the conformations, and after evolution they get 5.9. Is that the idea? Something must be the 100% towards which you are striving, according to a few tests.
Right. Yes. I believe for that.
Never mind. I mean, we shouldn't push you too much with questions because.
Okay. And also the measured response was shown by the fact that the evolved ligase was able to react to a greater maximum extent than the starting ligase. And in addition, the evolved ligase was able to fold better initially after transcription, as shown by the kinetics of the evolved ligase being faster when transcribed but slower when refolded, and that the substrate was able to inhibit the folding of the starting ligase but not the folding of the evolved ligase. And are we going to take a break? Conclusions, sorry. The use of isothermal amplification methods can be used to study ecological problems, and I guess the nice thing is that they're done on reasonable timescales. And since these methods use nucleic acids, the sequence and activity of the nucleic acids can be quantitated, and it allows for a molecular level of description of the changes that occurred during the evolution. As a result, mechanisms can be proposed to account for these changes.
Who's
got the references
again?
Yeah. Well, and I think my boss, my advisor, Jerry Joyce, and the other members of the lab and the funding and you guys. And, well, like I said, I have some, let me go back, the references. Oops. So actually, both of these are in the same journal. We shared the cover together.
Okay. So can we start again in 10 minutes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the next project I'm going to talk about is a project that I collaborated with a previous postdoc in the lab who's now an assistant professor at Northwestern, Terry Shepard. And he started the project and then I finished it. It's not really relevant to molecular ecology studies, so it's an in vitro selection for a DNA catalyst of a new function. So
I still didn't get this definition of what's the difference between in vitro selection and molecular ecology? Why do you give them different names?
Because you select for a catalyst with a new function as opposed to starting with an already functional nucleic acid and then evolving it to change to the conditions, as opposed to, you know, which changes the enzyme, but it's still doing the same chemical reaction. Whereas this is actually going to do a chemical reaction that that nucleic acid enzymes don't typically do, except for, nucleic acids don't do this one. So, let me think, is there an RNA enzyme that does this? No, there is not. So, here's a list of all the, well, not a list of, most of the RNA enzymes in the literature. And as you can see, they are able to catalyze quite a diverse number of reactions. DNA enzymes were also shown recently to be able to catalyze reactions as well. Shown here are the a few that it can do. So this is the study I'm going to be talking about is a new chemical reaction that the DNA enzyme catalyzes. So initially, the reaction that they wanted to be able to catalyze was that of cleavage of a disaccharide unit. And shown here is reaction mechanisms that enzymes use to catalyze this reaction in nature, involving protonation of the glycosidic bond, which ultimately leads to cleavage. So through a long, arduous synthesis process, Terry Shepard synthesized a building block that could be incorporated into DNA, which I'll get to why this is important for the selection. Through incorporated into the DNA using standard chemical DNA synthesis techniques. So the selection scheme that they were going to use was based on the selection scheme they used to select for the DNA enzyme that was I talked about earlier, that was capable of cleaving any RNA sequence, in which a 5' biotinylated RNA substrate is incorporated in a random pool, shown here in green, which is flanked by fixed sequences in pink, through the use of a DNA polymerase and primer extension. The pool is then bound to a streptavidin column through the biotin linker, and then the second strand of the pool is washed away with sodium hydroxide. Magnesium is then added to initiate the reaction, which allows the nucleic acid catalyst to fold and then catalyze the cleavage of the RNA, which can then be amplified using PCR. So in the selection scheme for the glycosidase reaction, they incorporated the disaccharide unit into the substrate using standard DNA synthesis techniques, and then incorporated that into the pool using primer extension, gel purified, bound it to a streptavidin column. Oh yeah, I guess I did gel purify the longer strand because the polymerase stops here. But bound it to a streptavidin column, eluted the molecules that were capable of cleaving the reaction, and then because there's a lot of background contamination problems in doing these selections, they added an additional gel purification method of the reacted molecules prior to going into PCR, and which they put the substrate in the PCR, and the TAC polymerase was the polymerase that extended it to incorporate it back into the pool. However, after 10 rounds of selection, they noticed that the cleavage reaction was actually not occurring at the cleavage site. It was not catalyzing the reaction they intended it to catalyze. And it was actually cleaving in DNA at a purine-rich site. Now, they noticed that the reaction was not inhibited by DTT, so it was not cleaving the DNA through an oxidative type mechanism, which had been shown previously. They noticed some other things about the reaction, namely that the reaction seemed to go to a greater extent when it was heated or treated with alkali. So they proposed a new mechanism by which the DNA enzyme was catalyzing the reaction, in which the DNA catalyst catalyzes the cleavage of the N-glycosidic bond in a guanosine residue, creating an abasic site, which can then beta-eliminate in an uncatalyzed fashion. This rate is a little bit faster than this one, as you can see, the uncatalyzed rate. So it was able to survive on this much cleavage. So to exploit this new, or try and make this activity better, they did a reselection, and in which they just replaced the disaccharide unit with just a standard DNA sequence and did 10 more rounds. Well, they mutagenized the population coming out of the 10th round and then did a reselection for 10 more rounds. So as you can see, over the course of the reselection, the activity of the enzyme got better. After the 10th round of the reselection, the population was cloned and sequenced. Shown here is a representative clone that was picked for analysis. So the enzyme, proposed secondary structure shown here, is capable of catalyzing the depurination of a single target residue in the in the loop, hairpin loop shown here. The rate of depurination that the enzyme catalyzed was pretty fast. It was about 0.2 per minute, which is about a million fold over the uncatalyzed reaction under these conditions. So the enzyme, the intramolecular reaction, could be made to operate as a true catalyst by cleaving here, so the enzyme portion would be from here back, the 93 nucleotides to here, and then the substrate portion would be this here. So it would bind the substrate through Watson-Crick base pairing here to catalyze the depurination reaction. The pH profile was shown to the activity of the intramolecular reaction was shown to be optimal at about pH 5. So the enzyme was probably catalyzing a pKa, well, I'll get into that later. It was also shown to be, the activity was shown to require divalent metal cations, in this case, calcium. Where is it? Oh, it's, I forgot that. Should say 2 millimole. Oh no, this is the calcium profile. Sorry. 2 millimolar calcium was at which the enzyme showed most activity. And shown here is the divalent dependence, and it was most active with calcium. So for the intermolecular format, it was fitted, here's a saturation plot of the reaction. In a standard Michaelis-Menten saturation plot. The Km for the reaction was shown to be 5.4 micromolar, and the Kcat about 0.02 per minute. This rate is about tenfold down from the intramolecular reaction. And so what we believe is happening is that the rate is getting inhibited by product release because the enzyme catalyzes the depurination but not the cleavage. And so the loss of a base, one base, is not an increase, doesn't cause an increase in entropy enough to drive product release as cleavage would. So each of these, each aliquot is first the reaction is allowed to occur, and then it's treated with a base to catalyze the beta elimination reaction. A truncation and substitution analysis of the enzyme showed that when this portion of the catalyst was removed, the activity was reduced. So this is just a proposed secondary structure, and what is actually the structure here, we're not quite sure. When the substrate was cut here, there was no activity. So the enzyme was unable to bind to what we believe is a duplex and catalyze the reaction. It was unable to form those tertiary contacts. It required base pairing here for the reaction. However, when the enzyme was truncated here, this hairpin was removed, there was no activity. So this enzyme is structurally complex. To explore this a little further, we noticed that when each of these cytosine residues were mutated to an adenosine, in the case of the top one, it reduced activity, and the lower two completely abolished it. So once again, this enzyme is structurally complex.
For example, more mutations and finding which ones were most deleterious, or just luck?
A little intuition. I just figured that if this hairpin is there, and if it's important for reactivity, I figured that first these are tied up in base pairs, so the hairpin loop would be free to perhaps bind to C to G here, some sort of interaction there. So I just tried mutating it, and it showed no activity. So lastly, we replaced the target guanosine residue with other bases. In this We replaced it with an adenosine, and there was no activity. When we replaced it with a deaza guanosine, there was no activity as well, or an 8-oxo. So the enzyme is specific for a guanosine residue there.
This loop somehow interacts with the substrate you could find the substrate.
Right. Yes. We didn't do that. Next, we characterized the products produced, because this is a new reaction, so you need proof of what's going on. We scaled up the reaction, and so the enzyme catalyzes the release of the guanine to create an abasic site, which is then driven to completion with piperidine to produce two products here, which were then submitted for mass spectral analysis. And as you can see, the expected mass matches that of the observed in the mass spectra. So I guess point out that after piperidine cleavage, you get phosphate termini produced at each of these ends. And the release guanine was characterized by HPLC co-migration analysis with the standard guanine. And then these were analyzed by UV. As you can see, they had similar UV spectrums. So to summarize, the initial selection was for a glycosidase, but with an uncatalyzed rate that was recently shown to be about 10 to the minus 13th per minute, it might not be too surprising that what we got out of the selection was a slightly easier reaction, the depurination of a guanine. Catalytic rate was enhanced about a million-fold over the uncatalyzed reaction, and it had an absolute requirement for divalent metals and was optimum at pH 5. So what we think is going on is the enzyme catalyzes a pKa shift of the N7 position of guanosine, which has been seen in other RNA structures, this pKa shift. So I guess its positioning in a pocket changes the pKa of the nitrogen. It's able to become protonated and then loss of the base. But that's just speculation, of course. There could be other things going on as well. The N-glycosylase DNA enzyme was shown to be structurally complex and consisted of 93 nucleotides. And that's it.
Thanks very much.
Sure.